a race to develop cars that exceed 100 miles per gallon. Now that's progressive.
From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Today we finish our week-long coverage from Atlanta. We're bringing you our show from Georgia Public Broadcasting, and we have local residents and fans watching the live show today. First up, highlights from this week's news with our reporters' roundtable. We've got Ernie Suggs, urban affairs reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, Chandra Thomas, assistant editor and writer for Atlanta Magazine, and Bruce Dixon, managing editor of the online news journal BlackAgendaReport.com. Happy Friday, folks.
Hey, how you doing? Welcome to Atlanta.
Thank you. Been having a great time here. So there's big news from Washington, D.C. this week. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled that using a three-drug lethal cocktail to execute prisoners is not cruel and unusual punishment. Now, the death penalty is legal in 36 states. 27 of them, including Georgia, require lethal injection as the only method of execution. Now, the argument brought to the courts by convicted death row prisoners and supported by some medical officials was that the three-drug cocktail posed a potential risk of excruciating pain if it wasn't administered properly. Ernie, tell me more about the arguments, and what did the court say?
Well, the court said that there's no definitive. Well, Justice Roberts said that since we're in a country that has the death penalty and 36 states have the death penalty, we have to have some way of using it, and a lethal injection is the best way at this point. You know, we've gone from the firing squad to hanging to electric chair, and at this point, he has ruled, and the court has ruled that the lethal injection is the best method that we have so far for using the death penalty. How that's going to affect other or these 36 states is that, as you can see very quickly, a lot of states have their attorney generals have moved to get the executions that they had on the books rescheduled, including some in Georgia. So I think that this is a move now by the courts that the state Supreme Courts are going to follow suit and just start getting these executions actually back up.
Ernie, just to follow up, what specifically is going on in Georgia? You mentioned that.
Well, we have in Georgia, as you know, this is a big, well, I shouldn't say big, but the death penalty is big in Georgia. So we have about 100 people right now on death row, three people who have exhausted all of their appeals. And two of them were scheduled to be executed last October. Those executions, the Attorney General Thurbert Baker announced yesterday that he is going to ask the state Supreme Court to reopen those cases or to re-put those cases back on the calendar. So we are looking right now at least two of those going before the Supreme Court for reintroduction to be executed. So,
now, Bruce, do you think that this is an issue that people are plugged into on a community basis in Atlanta, in Georgia? It has a different reverb in different states, but is it making an impact here in terms of people talking about what's fair and what's just?
I think it very much impacts what people think about the fairness of the justice system itself. It's almost as though these conservative legal theorists just wrote themselves a note to the teacher excusing their own absence and allowing them to do what they're going to do anyway. It just magnifies the experience of the law for ordinary people as being something capricious and unjust and whatever these guys say they want it to be.
Now, across the board, states like California, Florida, and Virginia are planning on resuming executions, but other states are reexamining the death penalty for different reasons. For example, in 2006, New Jersey put a moratorium on the death penalty because of questions around issues including exonerations of prisoners who were found to be innocent and potential racial and economic bias. So, Chandra, where do you think the death penalty debate stands on a broader level?
I think that the issue of the three-drug cocktail is an interesting issue, but I feel, particularly here in Atlanta and across the country, I'm a facilitator of a discussion group called Talk Black, and the sense that I've gotten in talking with my colleagues is we're more concerned about the disparities in the death penalty and how it is swayed toward African Americans and other people of color, and particularly when it is a crime committed against a Caucasian. And I feel that that's the issue that most people want to talk about.
Bruce, some folks look at this is not strictly a black and white issue, but there have been shown to be, as Chandra was saying, the people most likely to get the chair are blacks who commit crimes against whites. But some folks look at the broader civil rights issue and say, why are civil rights leaders always defending black criminals instead of focusing on everyday working people who don't commit crimes? Is there a question of whether or not there's a backlash against really examining these issues that have to do with crime as opposed to dealing more with other issues?
Well, in this era where people are so fond of saying that we're beyond race and that racial distinctions and racialism is behind us, that just doesn't match up with the facts. The federal government, the White House Task Force on Drugs, will tell you that the rate of drug use between whites and blacks is virtually the same, but the arrest and conviction rate of blacks is many times that of whites. So if there was anything like an equal justice system, that would not be true. There are black people are one eighth of the nation's population, but we are 45% of its prisons, and we're an outsized proportion of the people in death row around the country. And Latinos are about the same proportion of the American population as black people, and they are overrepresented in the nation's prison systems too. Native Americans even have a higher rate of incarceration and conviction than anybody does. So what we're looking at is we're looking at a profoundly racialized system of law enforcement here in this country, and it's been that way for quite a while, and it's something that people do not admit and do not want to talk about.
Ernie, I want to move us to another topic, the Delta Northwest Airline merger. Big news here this week, big news internationally even. So some business analysts say that the merged airline would be bigger, but not necessarily more efficient. How do you think this is going to play for Atlantans who were employed by Delta, people who were seeking employment, as well as on the larger stage of business?
Well, if you look at Atlanta, you know, I think about other industrialized cities and towns, and Atlanta is definitely an aviation town. Delta is a big employer here. Delta and the airport. Airport is either at some point the busiest airport in the world or the biggest airport in the world. We're building a $1 billion new terminal. So the airport and the aviation industry is really big in Atlanta. I think this move to merge Delta with Northwest and keeping the hub here in Atlanta, keeping the headquarters here in Atlanta, is going to be huge for the city. It just makes us stronger globally, makes us stronger economically. I think that, you know, as you know, there are a lot of things going on with gas prices and fuel prices and things of that nature, but I think that this is going to be a huge plus for not only for Atlanta, but also for the aviation industry, for the airline industry. And I think that hopefully, you know, I think all of the Delta officials and city officials and politicians have sworn that this is going to be positive. There are going to be jobs created. I like to think that is going to happen. And Atlanta will continue to boom with this.
Chandra, we've been talking to people throughout the week about how they feel about Atlanta, and people here are very proud. They have a few gripes, like the traffic. Do you think that building, expanding the airport is going to cause yet another bit of congestion, or do the benefits outweigh that?
Oh, I think, as Ernie pointed out, that the airport has been a huge asset, and there are a lot of cities in this region that had the potential, and the airport is what really set Atlanta apart. And, of course, you bring in the Olympics, and it's really a plus, because the fact that you can get anywhere all over the world definitely has an impact on the city. And I think that the biggest challenge with this merger is going to be how do they meld these two companies together? And I think the biggest thing that all of us care about is how does it impact the prices? How will I have to pay more for my flight? And also, will the services be decreased? And if there's a lack of competition, will we kind of be forced to pay those higher prices?
Bruce, what do you think about that? How are the passengers going to fare? Because I have to say, I'm flying out tomorrow, and every single seat is filled. Gone are those days before 9/11 when you could get a whole row to yourself.
Yeah, I'm looking for a couple of tickets to Dallas, if anybody knows any cheap tickets to Dallas. I got to see my son graduate. Well, mergers like this are always good news for the investors, but they are almost never good news for consumers and almost never good news for employees. I've never seen a merger that, on the whole, meant more jobs. Somebody is going to lose some jobs. Delta has a lower rate of unionization and therefore lower benefits, usually worse health care than Northwest. So I'll bet you that while investors are going to make out like big dogs, there's going to be some people who are going to lose their medical benefits, who are going to lose their retirement benefits. Ticket handlers at Northwest and baggage handlers are unionized in the main, and Delta's are not. So some people are going to lose their benefits, lose their homes. There's definitely going to be some losers here. And I've never seen a merger that meant lower prices for the public. Come on now. Who's ever seen that?
Ernie, when you look at the big picture of this, the gas prices, fuel prices are incredibly high. The economy isn't doing that well overall, so you've got less people doing discretionary travel, or maybe they'll hop in their car and go someplace local. Sure. Are you concerned that this could still be a very tough time for Delta Airlines?
Well, I mean, as you know, Delta's had a tough couple of years, you know, filing for bankruptcy. This merger will definitely help them. It will help Northwest. I think it will help travelers. I think it will give us more options. Although, you know, I think that the merger is going to give us more routes. The prices are still going to be high, but we're going to get more routes and more options. But I don't think this is going to particularly damage Delta. We are going to have to just, you know, we as travelers and as consumers are going to have to look at different options. We've been doing that for the last three or four years. You know, Bruce is talking about finding a ticket to Dallas. He may have to drive or take the train. So, yeah, I mean, we all have to look at our options.
Well, I have to say there's a great art exhibit of Shona Stone sculpture, which I'm partial to, in between Terminal T and Terminal A. So if you end up going through the airport, take the little tramway and take a look at it. So that's my plug. And Ernie, Chandra, and Bruce, stick with us. We're going to take a break and come back to tackle more local and national news. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. We are back with our Reporters Roundtable. Today we're in Atlanta speaking with three Atlanta journalists. We have Ernie Suggs, urban affairs reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, Chandra Thomas, assistant editor and writer for Atlanta Magazine, and Bruce Dixon, managing editor of the online news journal BlackAgendaReport.com. So welcome back, and I'm going to go straight into another topic about a big Atlanta company, which is Coca-Cola. It's a corporate sponsor of the Olympic Torch Relay and the 2008 Beijing Olympic Games. Now, the company is receiving some flack for that support because of controversies over China's human rights. Should it remain a sponsor? What do you think, Chandra?
Well, they seem to be kindred spirits. You have a lot of protesters protesting China and its practices, and also there's obviously been a lot of protests toward Coca-Cola and its practices for quite some time. And if you look at the numbers, that the recent report find that sales, net sales for Coke for China up 20%. So basically they need China to make that money. And I think as long as they are a company that is trying to make a profit, they will always align with who's giving them the money.
Bruce, the chief executive of Coca-Cola said, quote, the torch relay has symbolized openness, it has symbolized hope. Is that approach hypocritical given the questions over China's policies regarding Tibet and Darfur?
What it symbolizes is it symbolizes cash money. Coke is in business to make money. Coke is a transnational corporation, and China is, as Chandra says, 1.3 billion people, one of the biggest markets in the world. And if you're a transnational company, you do not buck governments. You get in bed with them. So there it is.
But I also think there is an effort here that, you know, people say, you know, you should back out, or someone should back out, or someone should resign. I don't see how Coca-Cola leaving or getting out of the Olympics is going to help DeFar at this point. So I don't see a reason why they should leave. And I think obviously Neville Isdell doesn't see a reason why they should leave either.
Now, let me stay with you, Ernie, go to a new topic, which is PTSD. A new independent study says that roughly one in every five U.S. troops who've survived attacks in Iraq and Afghanistan now suffer from major depression or post-traumatic stress disorder. That's an estimated 300,000 soldiers. And what is it going to mean for communities, including Atlanta, when these folks come home?
It's going to be rough. I mean, we're in the midst of a war that's, you know, people don't realize, but it's been going on longer than World War II. We have soldiers. We have a lot of bases here in Georgia. Every day we have soldiers returning home at Hartsville, which we talked about earlier. And these people are being integrated back into these communities where they're not getting the help that they need. Post-traumatic stress syndrome is something that's very, very serious. It's something that can sneak up on someone. So these communities are going to have to embrace these people, and the government and the Army and, you know, Walter Reed or wherever are going to have to be more progressive in getting these people the help to these soldiers that are defending their lives for us.
When you take a look at it, only about half of those soldiers with mental health problems have gotten treatment for their PTSD or depression. And Chandra, after Vietnam, a lot of black communities saw, you know, brothers and sisters, mm-hmm. brothers in this case, mainly coming home with, you know, just ending up on the corner. Do you expect that to happen?
Yes, and I think as we listen to this, it's just yet another casualty of war that cannot be measured. And I don't think that a lot of people are realizing the trickle effect. It's not just, oh, these people have post-traumatic stress disorder, but the effect on families, on, you know, if this person is unproductive, cannot work, the effect on, you know, marriages. So it's a huge impact on our community. And I think that the military is going to have to step up and figure out how to get these people treated in an effective manner. And I understand there's also a lot of concern about do mental health professionals want to be dispatched into a war zone? So it's going to be a serious impact, and we may be looking at the same results of Vietnam.
Bruce, what about the rapid decline in the number of African Americans who are new enlistees in the military? A lot of folks have linked that to the political tensions over whether or not this is a just war. But do you think the way that America is treating its veterans is also part of that?
The way that America treats its veterans is inseparable from what America does. A lot of these people are going to be suffering from PTSD, not just because of what they saw and what they did over there, but because they know that they were lied to be sent over there to do this. That's got to have an effect, too. Not just that you've killed, not just that your friends have been killed in your sight, but that you know that this was about a lie. So that's got to work on people. And it's hard to see what the ultimate payback for that is going to be. And as you said, Farai, if anything, the numbers of people suffering from PTSD are grossly, grossly underreported, because the military has made it very inconvenient, sometimes career-ending move, to ask for psychological help. Some people, it's been reported, who have been unwise enough to ask for psychological help have had their time extended because of that, and have been unable to leave the military and unable to go home because they asked for help. So there's going to be a lot to pay for, and we're going to be a long time paying for it.
All right. Well, Chandra, Bruce, Ernie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Ernie Suggs, urban affairs reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, Chandra Thomas, assistant editor and writer for Atlanta Magazine, and Bruce Dixon, managing editor of the online news journal BlackAgendaReport.com. And they all join me here in Atlanta at Georgia Public Broadcasting.